from KCRW and KCRW.com. I'm Kim Masters, and this is The Business.
What I saw and what interested me was everything that surrounded it in trying to explain why two groups of people, white and black, looked at one thing and saw something completely different. That interested me.
Ezra Edelman knew he had a rare opportunity when ESPN approached him to make a 5-hour documentary about O.J. Simpson. But Edelman had no interest in following the beats of the so-called trial of the century. Instead, his opus is a deep dive into race in America. Now, with his nearly 8-hour film, O.J. Made in America, shortlisted in the Oscar race, Edelman talks about how he tackled this massive project, how he got Mark Furman to talk, and why he hasn't watched the FX series, The People vs. O.J. Simpson. But first on the News Banter, Lucasfilm looks to launch Rogue One, the first standalone Star Wars movie. But the path was not smooth. Stay tuned, it's The Business from KCRW. I am joined by my partner in banter, Matt Bellany of The Hollywood Reporter. Hello, Matt.
Hi there.
So on December 16th, Rogue One, which is the first of the standalone Star Wars movies, will open. And I will just go back and remind everyone, in case they forgot, a year ago, Star Wars The Force Awakens opened to a staggering number, $248 million just in this country. That is huge. J.J. Abrams directed it. It really hit all the marks for people who had just been thirsting for a return to the original magic of Star Wars. I mean, there were complaints about this, that, and the other thing, but basically the elements were there. Obviously, the fans responded. This is not at all the same kettle of fish.
No, it's not. And, you know, obviously, The Force Awakens ultimately ended up grossing $2.1 billion. And the way that Disney and Lucasfilm have approached this standalone Rogue One is very interesting because they are hoping for the best, but they're downplaying expectations. This is not part of the episodes of the Star Wars series. The original stars are not in this. The stars are Felicity Jones and Diego Luna, who are not necessarily as well known. A lot of the trappings of the Star Wars movies, like the scroll and the lightsabers and things like that, are not in the marketing materials because they are trying to make this a distinguished thing. And the question is whether that's going to work. The early tracking shows it'll open to a very strong number, probably about 140, 150, which by any means is a great opening weekend. It's not 250, but I think Disney is kind of playing this smart. They are positioning this as Star Wars, but not quite Star Wars. And the reason they're doing it is because they want a Star Wars movie every year.
Every year, and that's a lot. And we know from the scuttlebutt that goes on in this town that this movie was troubled in the production. Disney did what a lot of these studios that are in universe movies, you know, whatever the universe is, Marvel, DC Comics, whatever, what they've been doing in many instances is to try to hire someone who does not necessarily have this huge resume, partly because people who do have huge resumes don't necessarily want to make these kind of movies where there's going to be a lot of direction from the studio. So they hired Gareth Edwards. He had done Godzilla. And it didn't go well with Gareth Edwards in the director's chair. Now, it's a very sensitive thing. The Directors Guild protects the prerogatives of directors, but it became well known that Tony Gilroy, the screenwriter of many films, including Bourne Identity, became kind of de facto doing a lot of directing.
Yeah, I mean, and Tony Gilroy, don't forget, he directed Michael Clayton, which got a Best Picture nomination as well. So he has experience there, and he's worked with Frank Marshall, who is Kathleen Kennedy's husband, Kathleen Kennedy, the head of Lucasfilm, so had a relationship there.
And Frank Marshall, of course, is the producer who produced the Bourne Identity movies and Jurassic World, I should say.
Yes, and from what our reporting suggests is that Tony Gilroy did so much work on this movie that he ultimately ended up making more than $5 million because they ultimately had to pay him his weekly fee for months at a time, and he was involved in post-production, a bunch of other things. So this movie did not have the easiest path to the screen, but these days a lot of these big tentpoles go through multiple versions, you know, script rewrites, post-production things, lots of reshoots, and now we'll see whether the public likes it.
Certainly Kathleen Kennedy at Lucasfilm is a very capable producer who did many of Steven Spielberg's movies, including E.T. And Gareth Edwards, I will say, is being a good boy in that he is not making any noise about this. He is just accepting what is, and that's the best move. Now, meanwhile, Good Girls, the Good Girls Revolt on Amazon, that was somewhat tortured segue, but I'm going with it. That show was canceled by Amazon recently. That is really unusual. The streaming services usually say, we'll give you a couple of seasons. Certainly Netflix generally does. Amazon canceled this thing weeks after its debut. This, you know, has a certain passionate following. It's about women who were working at Newsweek in the 60s. They dealt with a lot of sexism. This obviously reverberates with a bunch of women. And unusually, Dana Calvo, the creator of the series, spoke out to The Hollywood Reporter. She actually said that Amazon was being kind of weird in ignoring its own metrics for success, just because she alleges Roy Price, the head of the Amazon programming effort, just didn't like the show.
Yeah, she's been very outspoken, and she said that the metrics that Amazon shared with her, which are interesting, the things that they cared about were Rotten Tomatoes score, which she said was very strong, and this is interesting, she said that the people who were watching Good Girls Revolt on Amazon Prime were also buying products on Amazon at a much higher rate than their other shows, which first of all tells you a little bit about what Amazon's value proposition is in their programming. They're not just wanting viewership, they're wanting to sell more socks. So the correlation there is meaningful to them. And there's an outside company, Symphony, which takes stock of digital streaming ratings using this very complicated audio system. And they reported that Good Girls Revolt was a very high-rated show among a particular demographic of women. So those kinds of things were out there. Now, Amazon says that Symphony's ratings are totally wrong and that it wasn't working and that they didn't see awards prospects for this show. So there is that element of it. But the fact that a creator of a show is so outspoken criticizing the streaming company that is spending billions of dollars in this space is a pretty interesting development.
Yeah, I will say that this is not the first time we've heard of conflict with showrunners and streaming companies. Netflix also has had its blowback from some showrunners, and that is a bit of culture clash. The other thing that's interesting to me, I will mention this show is being shopped elsewhere. When I reported on Netflix, they don't sell socks, and they don't use that metric, but what I was told was a metric for them is not necessarily whether people watch it, but whether they put it in a queue to be watched. The intent to watch is what matters, because they feel that as long as you have something there with an intent to watch, you are less likely to cancel your subscription. So that's just an interesting compare and contrast between those two.
Well, by that metric, my intent to watch is probably about 80% more than my actual watch these days.
Right.
I think that's probably
explains
pretty
a lot about Netflix. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
That's Matt Bellany, executive editor of The Hollywood Reporter. This year has produced not one but two extraordinary series on an unlikely subject, O.J. Simpson. In February, FX began airing its scripted series, The People vs. O.J. Simpson, which followed the aftermath of the brutal murders of Nicole Brown and Ron Goldman. It went on to win 9 Emmys. The very existence of that series was unwelcome news for our guest today, filmmaker Ezra Edelman. He had his own project, O.J. Made in America, that was set to start airing on ESPN in June. Edelman's film is a 7-hour-plus documentary, starting with Simpson's childhood in the projects and exploring the racial tensions that gripped the country during his rise to fame in the late 1960s. While some black athletes were vocal on the subject of civil rights in that era, Simpson was not. His childhood friend, Joe Bell, explains.
O.J. went to USC in 1967. So he's plucked out of the black community, out of black consciousness, and he's submerged in an all-white university. And I say this, and I don't say it facetiously, but he is seduced by white society.
Edelman grew up as a biracial child in a political household. His parents, Marion Wright Edelman and Peter Edelman, are lawyers and civil rights activists. Though Edelman did not follow directly in their footsteps, his background has a way of manifesting itself in his work.
I mean, racial consciousness, that's just fundamental to my existence. That's just been my life from the time I was a child. And so every film I've done actually has to do with race in some form, even if it's been through the lens of sports. And so that someone came to me and said, hey, are you interested in making this film about O.J.? already knew it was fundamentally a story about race in America, and that was the way I was going to tell it. In fact, what I wasn't interested in, which I think most people are interested in, is who did it? Is he guilty? Like, I didn't want to do that. I wasn't interested in the trial and the sensationalism and the media event that was, you know, that year and a half period.
This is kind of a very bold and smart move on the part of someone at ESPN to bring this to you, it seems to me.
And I don't like giving him credit, but I do. His name's Connor Schell. You know, he's one of the guys who started 30 for 30, and he's the executive vice president of ESPN Films. It was his idea. The idea of doing something that was much more audacious as a conceit, which is he approached me about making a five-hour film. It wasn't, I want to do a thing about OJ. It was like, I want to make a five-hour film about OJ, and I want you to do it. I feel very fortunate. You know, it's somewhere between dumb luck and or you earn your luck. But like, this wasn't something I'd been going to bed and waking up every day with the idea that this is what I want to do. I really hope someone lets me do this. It was quite the opposite. And so that he had that foresight to take on a subject that had been done in some form many times, but I think he knew that it hadn't been done in any overly satisfying way.
A lot of people, I think, were not necessarily dying to see anything about OJ.
And I wasn't dying to make it. So what I saw and what interested me was everything that surrounded it and trying to explain how we got to that point and trying to explain why two groups of people, white and black, looked at one thing and saw something completely different. That interested me. I know enough based on sort of my interest in the things I've done. Like, I know who OJ is as an athlete. I knew where he's from. I knew when he went to USC. I knew what that place was. I knew where it was located next door to Watts in the years that we're talking about. He's there in 67. The riots were a year and a half before he got there in 65. I understand the paths of this story.
All in your head.
I had enough to go like, this story starts in the 60s the way I want to tell it, and this very much agrees with what happens in the 90s. So let me sort of draw this story on these two parallel tracks. I can figure out how they interweave and intersect as I'm going along. And I thought, that's something I'm happy to spend time exploring. I'm not interested in exploring what happened in 94 and 95, even if I understand fundamentally if I'm telling this big story with this big canvas, that's where this is going. So I have to do that too.
You have to, yeah.
But I can reframe the discussion.
Was there an issue at all about what the budget would be?
Always. I wanted more money than they were willing to give me. This is weird. I mean, I don't know. This is maybe weird to say. Like, I got from the concept of it and the way I am that this wasn't going to be the most fun exercise. So it was, this is what it's going to take to do this. This is going to be pain. So just don't make it more painful. And so what Connor, frankly, was great about is, you know, he's a guy who exists in a corporate structure and he has bosses and there are rules and things. And he, at every step, he said, this is what I can do right now, you know, in line with what I'm asking. But there's more. If you get to that point and you can justify it. So he was very sort of like, trust me. And in the same way he trusted me with the vision in terms of how I was telling the story, I in turn trusted him that he was going to lay the foundation and sort of at every point support what we were doing financially and creatively and otherwise. And so the fact is, I didn't know how to make a five-hour movie any more than I knew how to make a 50-hour movie.
Right.
So it was like, here are all the things in my brain that I'm trying to explore. I'm going to go out and do this. I have no idea who will talk to me. I have no idea what archival footage exists. I have no idea if I'm going to be able to put this thing together, but I'm going full bore trying to get it all done. And then when you come back with the material that when you start editing and you go, we got a lot of stuff here. And it's all meaningful, and it all agrees with one another. So maybe the 5 hours needs to be 6 hours. And he goes, okay. And when we finally screened a cut for them, and it was a little over 7.5 hours, it was like, this is great. And like, there's even some things that we might be interested in having you tell us more about or explaining further. And so that was a godsend.
So you said you didn't know who you would get. And I thought it was really interesting, but also for me as a journalist, you expressed in an earlier interview with somebody else that you didn't really care if you got OJ. And I can see why not, because he would just
Gum up the works.
Yeah. I mean, what's he going to say that's A, credible, or B, valid? It was just going to be a lot of self-justification or denial. And then you're compelled to put it in. I assume you were compelled to ask him and he helpfully declined.
All of what you said was accurate.
Okay, good. And what I was curious about is the first wife, Marguerite. I read somewhere that people cannot find her. She
married? Us included.
You could not find her.
We knew where she was. She has a different name, then she's remarried. But she's a perfect example of someone like, you set out to do this thing. And from the get-go, there's a list of people that we just put that said the impossibles. She was number one on the list as far as who would I would have wanted to interview.
That would be much more revealing than talking to OJ.
Correct. I mean, it's on all levels. You know, but you can't delude yourself into thinking that you're actually going to find this person and convince her to talk. There's a reason none of these people have done interviews. It's not like, oh, I'm the person that Al Collins is going to pick up the phone and say, sure, I'm going to do the interview with you.
Oh, no, you never know.
No, I pretty much knew.
You did?
And so it's like...
You've always got to take that shot, though.
You do, but like it's a weird thing of where you know you have to go to the mat for somebody or for some type of people to tell the story you're going to tell and not get so caught up in the feeling of like, if I don't have Marguerite Simpson or Marguerite Whitley or Marguerite, whatever her name is now, right. Mm-hmm. I don't have a film. Because I'm also very aware of the fact that what's the point of doing this if I don't have people who heretofore haven't commented on this story? I have to still do something that advances the story or there's no point.
There's no one can be indispensable in that context.
No one can be indispensable, but I will say that while I knew that Marguerite was going to talk to me and I knew that Al Collins and frankly no one really close to him and his family, and I accepted that, but we better find some people who can shed light on his childhood experience. We better find some people who are close enough to his family that you cross that credible threshold. And more importantly, when it comes to where we're getting to in this story, okay, here's a genre of people who haven't talked in 20 years, the prosecution. But I know I have to figure out a way to get at least one person to talk to me.
Yeah.
And so that is where the whole exercise, looking back on it, you realize it's this huge leap of faith. And you have to know where you really have to go to that point to make sure these people are included versus having the wisdom to understand that you can still tell the story if these other people aren't in it, even though obviously it would be more complete and more nuanced if those other people were.
Although you could end up just interviewing yourself to death, actually, talking.
Probably did that anyway.
You may have come close. I don't know. So you go to somebody like Mark Furman. This is a guy who said some and did some awful stuff. How do you go to him and say, hi, I just was wondering?
I tell my producer, Tamara Rosenberg, hey, you want to figure out a way to have Mark Furman be a part of the film? I mean, truth be told, like, there is a little bit of a method to the madness in terms of when you approach people. You know that you're approaching people who have been approached ad nauseum about this subject for the past two decades. If you don't have a sort of a foundation for what you're doing, why you're doing it, before you approach these people and be so well prepared and thought out in your approach, like, you're not going to get anywhere.
Yeah, so, just like being a reporter.
Yeah, I mean, it is like being a
reporter.
I
always circle outside and then I move toward the center.
Right, it really was concentric circles. And right. So with him, we did approach him somewhere like in the middle of the process and he said no, he wanted certain things that we weren't going to give
money.
Him.
I'm guessing, just a guess.
And like, that's a non-starter. And so I don't know. I honestly wasn't dealing with him. So I don't know what's going through his head. And we're dealing, he is his own representative. And so it's like, that's not going to happen. But I think that as we went further, he understood that this was a real thing. It was a big thing.
I think he
understood that all these people in the prosecution had agreed to participate. And so we'd already interviewed Gil Arcetti. We'd already interviewed Marcia Clark. I think that probably changed his viewpoint of like, well, I'm a big part of this story. I guess I should.
It will happen with or without.
I should participate. And I think, you know, to his credit, him doing it was an important thing for the film, but also I think it was good for him.
Coming up after a short break, Ezra Edelman tells us why he felt compelled to include brutal crime scene photos in his documentary. You're listening to The Business from KCRW.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is The Business, and I'm Kim Masters. We're talking to director Ezra Edelman. His documentary, OJ, Made in America, premiered at Sundance this year, all 7 hours and 45 minutes of it. Now the film is one of 15 documentaries on the Oscar shortlist. Edelman couldn't line up every interview he wanted, but he did get lawyers on both sides of the Simpson trial to go on camera. At one point, prosecutor Marcia Clark describes her frustration with Judge Lance Ito for allowing the jury to visit Simpson's home on Rockingham. Before the majority black jury arrived, the defense made a lot of decorating changes, including taking down Simpson's photos with his mostly white friends and replacing them with pictures of Simpson with African Americans. Carl Douglas was an attorney on the defense team.
Marcia saw the wall and she said, "Carl, you know damn well he has never had this many black people on his wall in his entire life." "Marcia, what are you talking about? How dare you accuse us of such things?"
I was miserable. I was angry. That is very dirty pool.
"If we had had a Latin jury, we would have had a picture of him in a sombrero. There would have been a mariachi band out front. We would have had a piñata at the upper staircase."
The jury's visit to the Rockingham house was dramatized in the FX series, People vs. O.J. Simpson. But other elements covered in Edelman's film were well outside the scope of that series. I read somewhere where you said you weren't sure when you were finished if there was any new ground broken, which, I mean, I hope you were being somewhat sarcastic or facetious or whatever the right word is, because, I mean, starting with the revelation that O.J.'s father was gay, which I don't think I had heard that anywhere ever.
This is the point. It didn't appear out of thin air. I read it in a book.
You did. Okay, so it wasn't somewhere
new.
Out there.
Right, so that's what I mean. So I mean this, like, I understand that most people didn't do the research I did in terms of how people engage this story. But the point is, that was a line in a book that I read. So it came from somewhere. It was reported. And I would tell you exactly who if my mind wasn't so scrambled and can tell you.
Credit
that,
to you, whoever you are.
What I don't know is when I go and sit down with his childhood friends and we're talking about who he is and his mother and blah, blah, blah. And I know I'm going to have to get to his dad and ask about it. But as soon as it comes up, the first thing out of his friend Calvin Tennyson's mouth is he tells me the story that's in the film about going and meeting his father the first time. And he just says it. It wasn't like, "Did you know his father was gay?" It was like, "No, he just told me his father was gay." And if I hadn't have known it, it would have been like, that would have been quite a reveal.
Yes. But the filmmaker gods were good to you because he just said it.
That's correct. And so there's a couple things. Like, I know it's new if I'm sitting across from a juror. And I asked her why she voted the way she did, and she says what she says in the film, which is that it was payback for Rodney King. And you're like, okay, well, no one's ever given voice to that. No one said that. So that's new. Is it a new idea? No. But that's sort of advancing the story in a meaningful way. So I do know that there are some things that are new. I just know that in some ways, because of the historical approach and how I sort of went about gathering information, what I feel is new is just the lens through which I told the story.
So, okay. I don't want to spend a lot of time on it, but at what point in this process do you find out about the scripted one?
My God, people love talking about this show.
I told you it'd be short. come on. The amazing thing is there's room for both of them in the world.
I have no beef. It's great. It's just, you know, you're in the middle of making something that
is you don't want to hear that there's something.
And then you're like, oh, someone's making a 10-hour scripted series about the trial. You're like, get the f*** out of here. And not in a good way.
Right.
And so I found out about it at some point last year, 2015. And then you go, okay, when's it gone? Okay, we're supposed to, at a certain point, we were supposed to be done by November. And it was like, oh, we're going to beat them. And then it was like, no, we're not going to beat them. And then it was like, you start watching these promos that they're cutting. And you're like, John Travolta?
I know, it sounds so unlikely.
It's like, it was just weird. Like a lot of things to do with this film and this process, it was weird. And so then you hear, we went to the TCAs in January. We're in a room full of reporters.
This is obviously the television critics meeting.
No one's seen our film, but everyone's seen six episodes of that.
Oh, so that's bad.
And so they're just telling me how great this thing is, and they're asking me questions about, how much is Robert Kardashian in your film? And I'm just like, I got nothing for you. I'm sorry. And I was worried about it because I honestly thought, well, this sounds good. Everyone's going to watch this. And if everyone watches this, no one's watching this other thing that's the same length, basically. And, you know, it's now come try. It's like my go-to line. Like, I clearly underestimated the culture's fascination with O.J.
Well, in credit to yourself and them, you also have to factor in that both of them are really outstanding. And there's room for two outstanding things and two forms.
The answer is, I guess so, and I can't comment on it because I haven't seen it.
you can't stand to watch it, or you just haven't gotten to it?
No, I mean, I think it's a different thing now than it was a year ago. I think a year ago, and even when it came out, it was, I know how much I put into this film that I made, and I know all of the sort of sides of it, and I know what I couldn't get to. The one person I really wanted was Chris Darden. Chris Darden had no interest in being on our film. Happened that we got the three other people, and Chris Darden is very much a character in the story. Having said that, the dynamic of who he is, you know, where he's from, what his career trajectory is, finding himself in this space, considering thematically what I was doing with the film, he was important. Johnny Cochran is no longer with us, you know? And so for me, I understood that, like, if I watch that show, it's going to be painful for me to watch characters and scenes portrayed and articulated in a way that I can't do in my film because I don't have these people. So you can sort of have scenes with the two of them. You can go home with Chris Darden. You can sort of explore this character in a way I can't. And so it's almost like self-protective. I was like, I don't need to see what you could do that I can't. So I'm not watching it.
Interesting. The crime scene photos, I had read, they blurred out the images. And then I was watching it and I was like, oh my God.
They
definitely did not. And it's like the kind of thing that you cannot unsee. It's very brutal. And I know, I think I've read you, maybe this is just a quick answer, you wanted it to be clear that there were two people who were brutally murdered who might have gotten lost in all the noise. Is that a simple, succinct way of putting it?
And I think what you can do in a film, you can take an audience on this journey to have them absorbed by the spectacle of what that trial became and all the things surrounding it. And I think that, yeah, people needed to be shocked back into understanding why we were there in the first place. Two people's lives were lost, and brutally so. And so that was important. I mean, I know my response to when I saw it, I was given a presentation by Bill Hodgman, the deputy DA. I had already been working on this thing for a long time. I was pretty inured to all of it. And so I'm like, oh, that made me feel something.
Yes.
And I'd never seen that before. And so the first response was like, I need to include this.
Nothing can prepare you for those images.
Nothing can. And you're right. I don't mean this flippantly. Like, nothing can prepare you and you can't get rid of them.
Yes,
but it's true.
It's
necessary.
So this was a 7 hour...
7 hours and 45 minutes.
Is this ever likely to happen again?
In the history of media?
Or in the history of you.
No, that's never going to happen again. This is a one-off for me in the eight-hour film genre.
And when you went into it, did you think, well, this will be shown in one sitting and it will be an Oscar contender? Or that was an afterthought about once after?
I mean, come on. I was like, just trying to wrestle the bear to the ground.
It was conceived as a TV thing, so...
It was conceived, as I said from the get-go, a long movie. It was commissioned by a TV entity.
Okay.
I understood that it would be shown on television. That was it.
Okay. Do you have interest in doing narrative film?
I'm interested in doing a lot of things. I like telling stories, and if I have the opportunity to tell stories in that medium at some point in my life, I will be open to it. I actually can't tell you the thing that will spur me. It might be the subject matter. It might be the form. It might be,
it
might be the
wonderful thing to be able to say, I want to see what...
Yeah, and oh, by the way, it might be because I have to make a living. And so this is the thing right in front of me, and this is the, I'm interested in it enough. So I'll say yes. You know, I think we get to a point in our lives where there are always these different crossroads, and the decisions right in front of you change. I thankfully have more opportunities to do things than I've ever had before. It makes that decision a little harder, you know, sort of like watching cable television now. Versus when I was a kid, there was three network channels.
Yeah, it was so easy.
Exactly. I knew what to choose. I knew what I liked. And so now...
Now we drown. Ezra Edelman is the director of OJ Made in America. Thank you for coming in.
Thank you, Kim.
And that's The Business. Caitlin Parker produced and edited today's program with production assistance from Ray Guarna. You can hear The Business on demand with the KCRW smartphone app and get the podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or wherever you download podcasts. I'm Kim Masters. We'll see you next week on The Business.